This week I'm joined once again by Jason Horsley, who is the author of Vice of Kings, Prisoner of Infinity, and Seen and Not Seen. In this episode, we discuss his latest book, 16 Maps of Hell, which is currently being fundraised from his website, horticulture.com. We discuss Hollywood, neurosis, obsession, and propaganda. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my patrons for making this work possible. And if you would like to support Hermetics Podcast or become part of the Hermetics community, please find our Patreon, Discord, merchandise, and donation links in the description below. Enjoy. So, Jason Horsley, thanks for coming back onto Hermetics Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation.
That's okay. So we are going to be discussing your book, which is yet to be published, but you have a Kickstarter for this, because I think you accept that there's going to be various difficulties in publishing this for a variety of reasons. So it's called Maps of Hell. And
16 Maps of Hell.
Oh, 16 Hell. Maps of Hell.
Okay. Yeah, I changed the title since I sent it to you. Also, it's not Kickstarter, it's my own. I just did it on my own website.
Oh, right, okay. But it's like a Kickstarter, I
think. It's based on that template, more or less. Yeah.
Okay. So 16 Maps of Hell. Kind of a fairly basic question, but how... This is sort of like your other work, Vice of Kings and Seen and Not Seen, but how would you describe this one?
I would describe it as kind of the culmination or even the synthesis of those previous three books, Seen and Not Seen, Prisoner of Infinity, and Vice of Kings, in that it brings together various different fields of interest, social engineering, even kind of trauma-based mind control is in there, which was the theme of Prisoner of Infinity, movies in Hollywood, which was the theme of Seen and Not Seen, and high-level endemic abuse, including sexual abuse, which is the theme of Vice of Kings. This wasn't intentional. I didn't think, well, how can I mash all these books together at all? But that's a convenient way to describe it now, at least for people who are familiar with my previous work. For people who are not, it's a deep dive into endemic systemic abuses and perception managements of Hollywood that I try to turn the conspiracy theory model on its head to some extent, or at least attempt to do that, to show that it's much more complex and nuanced than some sort of Illuminati Hollywood mind control operation, even though those kind of conspiratainment descriptors or narratives, they are, I mean, there's surprisingly quite a lot of evidence to back up those interpretations. It's just that I feel that they do more harm than good, because they just leave out too many of the nuances. So another way I describe it is an attempt to reconcile the cognitive dissonance in my own psyche as somebody who's grown up imbibing Hollywood product his whole life and feels really enticed by it to this day, including the lives of filmmakers and all that, with the more that I've come to know about the hidden machinations, you know, of society and of the media. It seems like they're two parallel perspectives and they seem completely incompatible. So I've attempted to actually bridge the two and try and find out, you know, the truth is somewhere between the two. Like, Hollywood is both what it appears to be and something very, very different.
So you have an obsession with Hollywood, which, as you yourself sort of understand it in a relatively self-analytical and sort of at some points judgmental way. Like, it isn't simple sort of Hollywood or hero worship or figure worship. You understand that you have this obsession with it and that there's something in that, and you're sort of, as I see it, trying to get to the real reasons as to why there are these obsessions and why one would become obsessed almost neurotically with these things. Is there somewhere that you, like, a point in your life where you can trace back to why you think you became, like, obsessed with sort of the Hollywood ideal?
Yeah, well, that's That's very much the focus of Seen and Not Seen, which began, well, it began in a number of ways, but one of the early impetuses for it was going back and looking at my first published work, The Blood Poets, when I was writing about movies in my late 20s and early 30s, without any real awareness of what you just asked, really, that there was a kind of dark, neurotic, obsessive side to it. I mean, I was aware it was there, but I wasn't ambiguous about it or ambivalent about it. I just felt, well, I really was determined to make it in Hollywood at that time in my life. And so I'd written The Blood Poets partly as, I hoped, a calling card for Hollywood. Like, if I can't get my scripts actually accepted and made, I'll write a kick-ass treatise on movie violence, and that would be a kind of a foot in the door to Hollywood, rather naive with hindsight. But anyway, when I was doing Seen and Not Seen, it was 15 or 20 years later, looking back over those early writings and sort of psychoanalyzing myself in a similar way that I did with Whitley Strieber in Prisoner Infinity, what was I revealing there that I wasn't aware of at the time? And thereby trying to get to the deeper roots of my obsessive dependence on Hollywood entertainment as an aid to dissociation, the technology of dissociation, which we talked about, I think, on our last time on Hermetics. And therefore, you know, kind of combine, use myself as a case study for what we think of as soft propaganda or mind control light, as in just the ways in which, if we're traumatized in our childhood, if we have very difficult adverse conditions in our childhood, such as I had with alcoholic parents and a bullying brother and other things that I touch on in Vice of Kings, then we're going to look for ways to escape. So initially for me, comic books was the first thing I really discovered for myself. And that soon led into movies, specifically horror movies, because my brother was into horror movies, and then Clint Eastwood was the turning point. So I was always aware that I had this evolution of an interest, let's say, or even an obsession, with kind of superpowered characters from Spider-Man to Clint Eastwood. And that helped me form an identity, and that identity included this desire to make it in Hollywood and be an artist and all that. So I was always aware of these things. But I wasn't aware of how deeply neurotic they were, and how much they had, in a sense, hijacked my life force and corralled me into a path, like established channels that weren't really conducive to my own fulfillment as a human being. You know, I was really trying to squeeze the round peg of my soul into the square slot of Hollywood success. And as I testify in Maps of Hell and also Seen and Not Seen, it was a futile quest. And over time, it morphed into trying to understand, well, why? A, why was I driven to this? And B, what is it about the Hollywood system that makes it completely incompatible and inaccessible to someone like me? Right? So obviously that's a big question. I mean, there's small picture, there's the local, my own psychology, and then there's the big picture, which is the social construction of Hollywood, such as it is, and that's where it overlaps, of course, with the socio-political forms of control, propaganda, and power abuse, and all of that that's becoming more commonly known about.
So, do you think that one of your reasons for writing it, that is, that you understood that there was a relatively collective desire along the same lines as your own? Like, there was a lot more people. Did you see more people like yourself who also were trying to fit into this but failing? Do you sort of see that there's only a few people who can ever be in Hollywood and the majority are sort of scrambling at it? Is there any reasoning for writing the book in that sense, to sort of make it clear to other people who were or are in the same predicament?
I mean, yes, but I think it is more widespread maybe than I mean, in a certain sense, it's a cliche, you know, all these starlets showing at Hollywood wanting to be stars, all these teenagers growing up wanting to be famous. I mean, it's commonly acknowledged, this. But in terms of actually people that we know, it might not be so obvious, particularly if we're in our 40s or 50s. So I think there's definitely subtler things. So I'd say that the desire to be a somebody, the desire to have respect and social status is certainly very, very widespread. And then so creativity and artistic self-expression somehow has got co-opted into that. Somehow that self-expression or art is all about self-expression, number one, which is questionable, I think. And then number two, self-expression is all about getting validation from the world for your self-expression. So you've got things that have been conflated together and mashed together into a sort of monstrous distortion of something that's fundamentally true and valuable, which I get to at the end of Map 16 Maps of Hell, which is, again, is this, what, it's not even self-expression, it's discovering who we are and by connecting to others, and that art is a form of communication. So I think we're all trying to communicate in one way or another, and artistic expression is clearly a way of communicating, and that has been, it's obviously it's been commercialized and commodified in such a way, but it's also been shoehorned into a pre-existing set of values. It's almost like you go to the market, like going to a plastic surgeon, you say, I want this nose, I want this set of eyebrows, I want this chin, I want those kind of ears, I want that kind of hairstyle. It's like Hollywood is a metaphor for the way in which society is customizing identities and then selling them back to us. And so it doesn't have to be Hollywood. Like some, I think this book would be particularly of interest to people who are under the spell of Hollywood, for sure. The danger is they might have their cake and eat it, as you suggested in your written questions. It can also stimulate the obsession with Hollywood, but that's sort of inevitable. If you're already obsessed, you've got to, you know, to detoxify, you've got to have the toxins come out. But I would also say that it might be just as effective or useful or meaningful to somebody who isn't so strongly identified with Hollywood values or those kind of ambitions, just as a template, as in we all have our crucial fictions, to use the term from Prisoner Infinity. We all have the ways in which we've allowed culture to shape us, and then we've developed these invested identifications with culture by which we're constantly looking for confirmation from the culture that we're getting it right, and that's the matrix telling us who we are, kind of set up, right? So sorting the seeds or surgically removing that cultural implant, although it might be differently configured, the implant, for different people, I think there's probably a general method to doing it, which I've tried to demonstrate with the last few books, in terms of looking at one's own psyche and then referring back to the world and society, and then back going back and forth between the two as a way to identify what's in our psyche that doesn't necessarily belong there.
And you know, you talk about Hollywood altering and creating identity, and altering us in ways which form identities. And one of the things that comes across early in your book, 16 Maps of Hell, is that there is a primary reliance on Hollywood on image, obviously. I mean, it's based around cinema and how people look and how things appear. And do you think that to a certain extent, even the conceptual forms of one's identity is sort of flattened by Hollywood into, you know, quick statements, and you could almost say just images themselves? You know, there's very little substance behind the representation with regards to Hollywood and with regards to one's identity, which they've made from Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's quite a bit of writing on this. I'm not very familiar with it. I'm just reading a book, I think it's called Edgar Morin, who writes about this, how stars become images of themselves. Also Society of the Spectacle, Guy Debord talks about that. It seems as though there's something, and it's even in the Bible, like this idea of idolatry, and why did Jews, the Jewish people, initially have the prescription against graven images, like you can't represent the divine. And of course, now we're living in a culture where everything is about screens and images. So I think, I think you're asking a very big question, and I guess I'm attempting to answer it by suggesting it's not all about Hollywood, but Hollywood is maybe can show something that is endemic in the culture, which does have to do with creating a counterfeit of ourselves and then letting the counterfeit live our lives. So we could certainly see that with stars, that there's a sort of symbiotic relationship between the star and the characters that they play, and they get identified with the characters that they play. But then as a star, they also have to turn their lives into a movie, as in they represent something as stars, not the characters they play, but the character of the star, him or herself, whether it's Keanu Reeves or Johnny Depp, Kate Winslet or Angelina Jolie or whoever it is. They become an image in their own lives, and then they have to maintain that image in order to maintain their currency, so to speak. So, and then we ourselves imitate the stars, like I imitated Clint Eastwood well, and that was a mashup. I was kind of imitating Dirty Harry and The Man with No Name, the character on the screen, but I also wanted to be a filmmaker. Didn't want to be an actor, but still. So who was I imitating? Was I imitating Clint Eastwood, or was I imitating the Dirty Harry and the Man with No Name? Well, it was both and it was neither. It was this synthesis of imaginary characters, including Clint Eastwood as the imaginary character. Now, it's easy to imagine when we have to speculate, but I do get into this somewhat in the book, specifically Heath Ledger, for example, who died very young, I think, as a victim of this kind of syndrome, also Barbara Streisand. But it's easy to imagine how, and Michael Jackson, how an actor or a famous person would lose themselves in that. Like they would get so invested in pretending to be somebody that they're not, and their whole career and status depends on that, that they would almost have a vested interest in forgetting that they were acting, just as a good actor's kind of supposed to forget that they're acting, method actor and so on. And I do think that Hollywood probably isn't causing this so much in our society as it's symptomatic of something we were already doing. It's why I tried to trace Hollywood back to secret societies and ancient rituals, which were to do with deceiving communities and wielding power over them and getting them to invest in beliefs and literally invest in terms of money, but also invest their attention and energy so that they would then be compliant or susceptible to manipulation. This has gone back very, very far, this kind of tradition of using imagery to get people to disassociate from their physical lived experience of who they are and start investing in images. And then with mimesis, which I think we talked about last time a bit, and this, the Greeks were about this as well with their cathartic theater. There's something inherent about when we watch images, human beings acting out, because of this mimetic quality to social arrangements, we internalize what we see, the image. We internalize the image, and then we let it possess us, and we go into imitative forms of behavior of that. So we're also getting possessed by an image that's false. And so then we're becoming a counterfeit of ourselves. And I guess there's some relief in this. I mean, bring it back to very, very difficult situations for me as a child. There was an enormous amount of relief in reading Spider-Man comics and imagining that I was Peter Parker, who had a hard life as a teenager, but he was secretly Spider-Man. And then moving on to Clint Eastwood, where there was less ambiguity there. It was just a very strong man, and I got to model myself after that and just escape into these dissociated realms where I felt like I was becoming somebody different. And in a certain sense I was, but I was becoming an image. I was becoming a two-dimensional version of a human being.
And you mentioned there that the actors have to invest into the, you know, both the characters they're playing, but also they have to invest in themselves. You know, Brad Pitt is Brad Pitt. He isn't somebody. He is Brad Pitt, sort of TM. Same with basically any celebrity name. Different connotations are formed in one's mind when they hear the name of a celebrity as opposed to someone else. I mean, even if you're not, you know, sort of a big fan of celebrity or fame or Hollywood, I don't think anyone could admit that a sort of national or globally recognized name, you know, is definitely going to bring up different connotations. But yeah, when you talk about the fact that they have to sort of sculpt their own character, it's not just them who's sculpting it though. It's sort of the collective which collectively agrees upon the identity that we've given them. So, you know, like, this is one of the questions I had is, and one of the ideas that's sort of running out throughout Maps of Hell is that because of this, these consistent false identities that are given to us via the media, we are, Hollywood, at least as I think you see it, is sort of a general theatric. That it's extremely difficult to get down to the root of anything. Like, the whole thing itself is a production. So there's nothing genuinely real there. And I mean, that's tough to sort of say what that is generally, but it seems Hollywood is pushing the idea of like theatrics and production. And this cult goes on, like, this cult has sort of grown to a certain serious degree now where we trust celebrities as authoritative figures. We hear them talk about certain things and we trust that over the voice of, well, anyone else. But, you know, I can't remember which actor it was recently. I think it might have actually been Brad Pitt, which is probably why his name popped into my head. But he said, you know, why are you listening to actors talk about politics or talk, I think it was some, might have been something to do with coronavirus, you know, he said, why are you listening to us, we're just actors. And I think it bemused a lot of people because they hadn't thought about it in those terms. And I think there seems to be a sort of equating status and popularity with authority, which is generally politics.
Well, yes, again, it goes very far back, this, you know, the priestcraft, this idea that there's a social caste which is more evolved than the mass populace, and we can look to them for guidance because they're directly connected to the gods. Now, there isn't much illusion about that as far as politics anymore, I suppose, but although that's kind of questionable because people are still voting and thinking that politicians are going to save them, so maybe I'll retract that, but it isn't so obvious with politicians. And part of that is the glamour, you know, the glamour aspect of politics is radically reduced and de-emphasized. It's still there. Whereas with Hollywood, the glamour is front and center. Glamour magic is a term that I've used in the past. And it seems as though there's, like, Hollywood is just the latest iteration of something that we could see in societies and even social organization from the inception. So I, you know, I introduced the Brian Hayden's thing about the power of ritual in prehistory, that book, and about secret societies and how they functioned. I only discovered that, or only managed to read it rather, just as I was finishing 16 Maps of Hell. So it was a bit of a last minute synthesis of that thesis with my own, but I did feel it was worth doing at the 11th hour, because I think that, I mean, you're saying nothing is real about Hollywood, and yet, of course, there's human beings there, and there's buildings, and, you know, all the components of Hollywood are just as real as the components of any other town, and yet it is in the business of deception and illusion. So I think the thing to consider there, or maybe introduce there, is that religious belief is about a higher reality that we can't see, that's invisible. And so there is this kind of thing in the Hollywood thing that I mean, it's that there's the cliche, isn't it? Is that art is, what's it go about? If you tell a lie well enough, it becomes truth. You know, creative self-expression is about just telling lies so well that they become true. Again, method acting, at a certain point, an actor can get so possessed by the character. This is around the mythos around Heath Ledger's death. You know, was he possessed by the spirit of the Joker? There's something there that is both fabricated and manufactured, I think, as a way to lure us and keep us fixated on Hollywood, but also that's somehow true as well, that there is a metaphysical dimension to reality, including Hollywood. And so it is possible that by handling illusions in such a way, they become real. And so, like a movie star who plays very powerful characters becomes powerful thereby. So they are actually, and they become a hero to people. I mean, Robert Downey Jr. is an example I use in the book, to beginning and the end, but like, and he's an interesting case study, of course, because his trajectory is so extreme. But I brought him up now just because he's played all these heroes recently and he's become the number one movie star in Hollywood, which is, in a certain sense, one of the only equivalents we have for superheroes in our world is an A-list movie star, as in someone who's just, against all the odds, has just become this super powerful figure in the world. And yet, really, an A-list movie star, the kind of qualities that requires are closer to a supervillain, if you use the Hollywood, the comic book context, right? Because it's sort of vanity and self-aggrandizement and social influence and things like this. They're much closer to supervillains kind of characteristics. But in the case of Downey Jr. and others, as you say, Brad Pitt, they try, I guess they counteract that by trying to become socially responsible individuals who are using their wealth and their influence to do good. So in the case of Robert Downey Jr., he's involved in some huckster thing, Elon Musk kind of scheme to reduce the carbon footprint with robots. I can't even remember, but it's in the last part of the book. I cite it as how this transformation is happening, where in this case, like a son of a director becomes a movie star, then becomes a drug addict, then becomes a felon who's in prison, and then makes it out and gradually works his way back to the top, or then hurtles to the top with Iron Man, and becomes, you know, the most popular actor in the world. And now he's become a kind of Elon Muskish kind of, or he's trying to make the transition into a real world social engineer, a real world superhero, who's really a supervillain, I would say, because he's manipulating things. But anyway, that's all very interesting to map in the sense of your question, hopefully come back to it, about how we may be looking at a kind of belief that's very similar to religious belief, that sort of mixed with New Ageism, which is, if you can connect to the gods and you can do the right rituals, you can become a god. And that's what these people, maybe they believe they're doing it, I don't know, that would be very speculative, but they certainly managed to convince other people of it. It's the secularized version of gods, essentially, the movie star.
Well, this is something else, you know, that you've made clear there, is this entire I can only really describe as a thing, is based upon this idea of attention, and that there's people who are worthy of more attention or longer attention. I mean, and I don't think this has anything to do with the attention economy. This isn't sort of trying to, grasp tidbits of people's attention on Twitter or trying to market something to them. The attention given to celebrities is still fairly long form, and people are interested in entire narratives and life stories and plots regarding. And you say attention is the currency of existence. And, you know, I don't know if you mean this directly in relation to Hollywood, but what's interesting to me is that currently, due to the coronavirus, which has sort of revealed so many strange things, we're actually seeing many celebrities fall apart, like mentally and often quite literally. And it seems to be because they haven't got attention, and the production values which uphold the myth and the ritual and the theater and unto which they, you know, exist within, it's like it's gone. You know, they're not able to have it. And it's all falling apart, and they're sort of having these strange breakdowns. Do you think that behind Hollywood, there's actually very little to show there? You know, in terms of anything which is worthy of people's attention?
Well, I think there's something worthy of attention, but it's probably this shadow that's been concealed. So it's like the Dorian Gray. I use that analogy in the book halfway through. Dorian Gray himself, this eternally youthful, rather beautiful, decadent young man, shallow and social kind of butterfly. He gets a lot of attention maybe because he's got charisma, but essentially he's living this vacuous life of self-indulgence. And behind the scenes, he's made a deal with occult forces to retain his health and beauty no matter what he does with his life force. And the way that it works is that all of the corruption that he's engaged in only shows in this painting. I can't remember the exact mechanics. Obviously, it's not a realistic story. It's a parable, Oscar Wilde. So anyway, the painting gets uglier and uglier and more deformed and hideous because that's showing the true nature of Dorian Gray's soul. And I'd say that's the aspect of Hollywood that does merit our attention, as opposed to the glamour magic, which is harvesting our awareness, our energy, by giving us pleasing dreams or stimulating dreams that help relieve the tension and the pressure of reality, which is something we're always doing anyway to ourselves. But these are manufactured, like you said, about movie stars, although I think you made that very good point, the movie stars, that we're creating them very much in a sort of supply and demand symbiotic relationship. So that's, we've got to put that in there too. That's another reason that Hollywood does, there is some value in giving Hollywood attention again as a mirror, because if we've created it to the extent that we've believed in it and invested in it, you could say that we have co-created it. And it's actually my friend or collaborator Dave Ashana made this comment about, he also used the example of Brad Pitt. He said, like, if he saw Brad Pitt in a restaurant and or wherever, he would go up and talk to him because he feels as though he has had a hand in creating who Brad Pitt is. So he has every reason, not to be shy about that. But I mean, it doesn't mean that he would try and grab a chunk of his hair or anything, but there is this symbiotic thing there that and one of the ways that Hollywood is, it's a balancing act they've done in Hollywood, because they try and create the stars, or these stars are created that they're supposed to be above us and lofty, but at the same time we have to feel intimate with them, like we know them. So then they have to be accessible in a certain sense, but their private life, supposedly, it's probably all made up. But anyway, they give us a sense that we're finding out about their private lives. But at the same time, and they want people to come up and approach them for autographs, really. I mean, they need that kind of attention anyway. But at the same time, if people get too intimate, people start to realize that in a way we're on the same level with the stars, then that would break the illusion, and also a star would be threatened. They wouldn't be able to just move around in society. I suppose most of them don't anyway, but that's one of the reasons they don't, is that they don't want to get mobbed. They don't want people to take liberties and assume that they know them and approach them like they're just ordinary people. They have to maintain that distance. I forgot where I was going with this now.
Hollywood,
the dark side. It was the dark side, yeah. So another reason they have to keep their distance is that, of course, is to maintain the illusion, like this intimate view that we think we have of Hollywood and movie stars behind the scenes. Well, because more and more, it's becoming more and more obvious that was just another level of fiction. And in order to maintain that level of fiction, because there has to be enough distance so that we can't check and verify, whether it's true or not. There has to be complicity within the system itself not to, leak information and so on about what's really going on with this or that star or this and that studio and so on. Anyway, so of course, what's been coming out in the last few years, I'd say since Jimmy Savile really, but it's obviously in the US it's more since Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey, is suggesting, of course, that the real lifestyles of the rich and famous are quite destructive, quite abhorrent to us. And there's a fascination in that as well. But I would say that it seems to me it is worth paying attention to that in terms of what are our idols really up to? We've given them all this power. We've projected all this virtue onto them. We've let them behave like gods. We've treated them like gods. Well, they end up acting like gods. And you remember the myths of the gods. The gods never behaved themselves very well, and they certainly didn't treat humans well. So it's weird, isn't it? Because we've really lost touch with the kind of archetypal template that we've recreated with Hollywood. And Hollywood's largely responsible. We've been so brainwashed into believing the Hallmark Hollywood version of things. Of course, it's going to create a breeding ground for all kinds of vice and predations and depravity. Because, you know, if people can get away with it, they'll get away with it. But also, there's that pressure, which is kind of in the Dorian Gray thing. Is the more good and positive and virtuous they have to appear to us to maintain their power, the more they've got to suppress that dark stuff, and the more it's going to come out once they're, you know, behind closed doors and nobody's watching. This Jekyll and Hyde.
You know, all this sort of celebrity lifestyles and tittle-tattle, and you know, the 16 Maps of Hell is extremely dense. It's full, you know, chock full of facts and data and sort of old news stories, and basically pulling apart celebrities' lives to the point where you're sort of just dealing with a strange assemblage of events and ideas as opposed to an actual person. But at what point do you see this as anything other than just investing your time into celebrity gossip? You know, this is like a meta gossip, but do you feel that there's something that you're doing that is more important? Are you sort of analyzing the gossip as a the form of social control that it is? Or do you think that you're still in some way bolstering like the gossip framework?
Well, I think it's a good question, but I think we have to break it apart a bit, because I mean, gossip is questionable. I mean, what's gossip and what's testimony and what's evidence? So I think the thing that I would most comfortably associate with gossip would be more this kind of fake news stories about Keanu Reeves says that babies are drinking blood, and those kind of stories are clearly not reliable. Even if there's some truth in them, they've clearly just been made up at the same time. So I certainly bring out some anecdotal evidence there, but more that's to do with the evidence of disinformation and how it seems to be operating and functioning in order to confuse us. In terms of gossip, I mean, I'm referring to biographies and as good a source as I can. So I would question the use of the term gossip. But if you're talking about, you know, celebrity biography, then yeah, I'm referring to that. And I am aware that for me personally, there's two things going on. One is I want to get free of my own fixation on Hollywood, because I think it's a waste of time and energy at this point. So then why write a book about it? Well, to get free of it. Like, can I really knock this on the head? Can I really present enough evidence for myself that I can? Because, you know, they say the thing about the brain can't leave an anomaly alone, like an infected tooth. We keep sticking our tongue in it. If there's something in our environment or in our experience that we can't resolve, we can't just put it to rest and just say, well, whatever, I just don't know, I'll just forget about it. We just keep going back there because of the cognitive dissonance. So for me, Hollywood represents that, you know, because for the first 20 years of my life, I received the program that Hollywood was the way it was. And those first 20 years, it goes much deeper than what we receive after that. It was only in my 20s that I started to find out more concrete evidence about the twisted nature of society and the way that it manipulates and controls and oppresses and abuses us, and to intuit and deduce and then find evidence that Hollywood was part of that. But so that's, and 30 years of that hasn't necessarily been enough to undo that initial programming or that initial, you know, cultural imprint and belief system around Hollywood. So I'm still trying to do that. So that's number one. Number two is, well, because of that implant, let's say the Hollywood implant, I still like reading about movie stars. I still do get drawn to what you're calling the gossip. I think in a way gossip's fair enough, but I also want listeners to be clear by how we're using it, but for example, you know, David Finchner and how he worked on Zodiac and the different, you know, that the way that movies are actually made, that's not strictly speaking gossip, that's industry knowledge, that's inside, somewhat inside, not that inside, but about how Hollywood functions as a system, right? So that's a spectrum with what it was more like movie star gossip, which is how a different star behaves, right? But the behavior is it's endemic, it's systemic. So one of the things I'm trying to map is a power abuse endemic to Hollywood, including sexual abuse? And if so, what's the evidence and how has it been concealed as long as it's been concealed? So in that sense, looking at the micro movements of different celebrities, that's kind of my MO, as I did it with Whitley Strieber as well. But I was just going to, I didn't finish my other point, which is I am aware that actually potentially this kind of feeds a particular fixation I have, because I get to think about and read about and write about Hollywood for another year or something. So I am acutely aware of that. The third thing is that what I was attempting with this book was a sort of meta thing as a writer. Is I wanted to make this a final pass over the charred earth of our socially engineered hell world that I've mapped in these previous books, because I want to start focusing on other things as a writer. I don't want to just be spending, you know, my whole life just looking at horrible kinds of social manipulation and sexual abuse and trauma and violence. It's all pretty dark, unpleasant stuff. So what I set out to do with this book was, can I actually cover all this ground and yet somehow lead myself and the reader to a positive perspective? Can I resolve all this on a positive, strong note? Hence the metaphor of mapping hell with a rough 16 maps of hell with a rough draft of the exit. So the last two chapters, I make this, I'm tempted to say heroic, but one should never describe oneself as heroic, but really difficult, really ambitious thing of, after all these pages and words of micro mapping the abuses and the neuroses and the pathologies, to try and draw out some gold from all this lead, to try and transmute it in the last couple of chapters. And if I could do that, then I would end my own that phase of my journey. So end my Hollywood obsession and fixation by fully exposing its neurotic dimensions and you know, the unworthiness of Hollywood as a absorber of my attention, but also by extension reaching peace or some sort of closure with the need to constantly map and analyze the dark side of our world.
So what were the, you know, can you give some of the examples or the ways in which you found, was the primary way in which you found to exit Hollywood simply to reveal, you know, its inner dark side? Is that the way you believe people should find a way out if they're also stuck in this sort of life of imitation and mimicry, is to just reveal how awful it is and then leave it be? Have you found that to be a helpful way for yourself?
Well, yes. I can't say with absolute certainty that it's work, because for it to work, I'd want to be absolutely in the clear. I would say I think I'm in the clear in terms of trying to make it in Hollywood. I mean, if I got an offer from David Fincher tomorrow, then we'd find out, right? Of course, saying no wouldn't necessarily, I mean, it's all about the way in which one gets sucked into things. So, but I think that I've more or less conquered my illusions about that. And I mean, that's part of a larger complex, which I mentioned at the start, which is, you know, just the desire to attain status in this world, whether it's through Hollywood or anything else. That drive has been very strong in me because of my cultural conditioning, and Hollywood just became the dream that I I put all my attention on. I think that that's more or less more or less woken from that dream. I mean, looking at Polanski was useful in that regard, because maybe we'll go into that or not, but he was a very early role model, and I really, by writing this book, I really just had to face the fact that Polanski's probably a really nasty piece of work, and that was a lot of cognitive dissonance for that, because as somebody that I really, you could say, I felt kind of love for and wanted to emulate. So I think it has to be quite close and personal for something to really shift. It has to be quite painful. It's not just about saying, yeah, Hollywood's a bunch of predators and they're all, you know, child abusing Satanists. That doesn't work. One has to really find one's own key joint, or something that's quite deeply implanted in one's own psyche, and start moving that around. So I think that was happening, or happened through the book. The other thing that's much subtler is, and that I explore in the book too, which is, what are the effects of watching these products if they're made by people who are pretending to be something they're not? So an obvious example I use, you know, Kirk Douglas, I cite the case of him raping Natalie Wood, which Natalie Wood's family have recently gone on record about. I don't think it's in the HBO documentary, but it is in the biography that the sister wrote. And Kirk Douglas, and it was very violent and just a horrible thing that apparently happened to Natalie Wood. And Kirk has completely got away with it because he's still alive at 105, but that's not my point. My point is that he was a role model during that period, in his 40s, in the 1940s and the 1950s particularly, and even in the 60s. He was one of a very small handful of male movie stars that modeled masculinity to the masses. Burt Lancaster is another, John Wayne, Robert Mitchum. You count them on one hand, like these key role models for American and other people internationally that men were imitating and women were desiring. Now, if Kirk Douglas was actually, you know, a violently abusive rapist, maybe did it many other times, we don't know, but even one time is enough to suggest he's no hero. That is in his body, it's in his whole being. So when we're watching and imitating Kirk Douglas, consciously or more likely unconsciously, we're imitating a violent, abusive rapist, a sociopathic personality, without knowing it. And so that goes all the way into our nervous system and in ways we can't even imagine. So I'd extend that to also the scenarios in movies. We're watching violent heroes inflict violence on their, not on their victims, but, you know, on the bad guys, or both. It happens in both ways. Torture, you know, heroes torturing to get evidence. Whatever it is, a lot of violence. Our nervous system is constantly being triggered by that. The images are going into our retinas, into our brain, and then into our nervous system. We're having the physiological responses. It stays in the body, as far as I can deduce. It's one thing I was exploring in the book anyway. So where does it go? It's just like running beneath the surface, the threshold of our conscious awareness, all of this kind of stimulated fight, flight, reaction response in the body, constantly being re-stimulated. Combined with the images, they're also staying in the unconscious, whatever they are. We're constantly, it's a kind of consumption that is closely comparable to eating toxic food or junk food or certain kinds of food anyway that we maybe don't know the ingredients of, and maybe it is messing up our system. And if we keep eating it, then our system will never recover. So this hasn't been, is where I'm getting to, this hasn't been successful enough, this analysis, for me to say no more Netflix or no more, you know, I'm still watching TV shows. So I don't know if that, I'm not sure what's happening there. Like, am I just making it worse in a certain sense because I'm doing it now that I know, or is my consciousness helping me to process in some way? I really don't know. I mean, I watched a thing yesterday, a girl got her knee hurt, and I felt my whole body in pain when they were showing that, and she was at the doctor, and it didn't used to be like that. I never used to notice how my body would go into this quite distress when it sees violence or hears about violence. That's only in the last couple of years. So presumably if that got sensitive enough, I would stop enjoying these things, and then I then I suppose I'd be free. But in the meantime, if I'm getting more sensitized, that seems like that must be a good thing.
And if you know, all of this is heading into our nervous systems, and that is, you know, we can't say that those character traits that we don't know about in their real lives, you know, we can't say that's Hollywood propaganda, but certainly the attitudes and the characters that they're writing and the structures they're devising, these are things that we can consider as like archetypes and structures which they want to promote. And a strange question for me is, you know, one of the key traits of propaganda is that it has an end game, right? It has a goal. And what do you think the goal of Hollywood propaganda is?
Well, I think there are two kinds of propaganda. First of all, this is this, Jack Ellul writes about this, is that what we think of as ordinary propaganda, or what we think of as propaganda, which, as you say, has a very specific goal to get people to believe certain things and behave in certain ways. But then there's what Ellul calls sociological propaganda, and that is much harder to track because it's replicated by societies itself. So it's to do with the values in a society that then become embodied by individuals. Really, we're talking about individuals, even if we go into institutions, it's all made up of individuals. And then it's being carried forth by those individuals that create organizations, including, of course, the products. So a lot of Hollywood movies, we could say that they're propaganda without any direct involvement of the CIA or the military, and you know, there's plenty of examples of that, but because the individuals who make them are possessed by the values that have been propagated in the society by more overt forms of propaganda. So it's such a huge spectrum that to talk about the actual goal of Hollywood propaganda, one could go to either end of the spectrum. So I'd say at the close end of the spectrum, the goal of Hollywood propaganda is quite base, like advertising really, is just to sell itself, to make itself seem more vital and meaningful so people will keep imbibing it, right? So it's to propagate the values of Hollywood also. It's kind of inseparable from what I just said. As in, if Hollywood creates a good product that wins awards and that moves us emotionally and all the rest of it, it may not need much of an extra propaganda thing in there, as in promoting the military or glorifying the CIA, to use obvious examples, because, and in fact, it would be less effective as this kind of propaganda if it had those things in, because then we would say it's not such a good film. If it seems like a socially responsible and a conscientious and a sophisticated work of art, say Fight Club, let's say, use an example, because Finch is in the book, then it's propagating the idea that Hollywood itself is a worthy receptacle of our attention and a worthy dispenser of values, right? So that's very essential in itself. Now, you could say, well, it's a bit circular, because if Hollywood's just propagating itself, what's the harm in that? Well, of course, the harm is that many of the products are harmful or are more overtly propaganda. But then there's also the subtler messages, and Fight Club would be a thing to deconstruct, because I used to think it was a subversive work, but now I'm not so sure. You know, now it seems like it actually does have some much more subtle forms of propaganda in there the more overtly subversive work is a delivery device for. I'll just finish up, because I know I said that was one end of the spectrum, and the other end of the spectrum would be the larger goal of Hollywood propaganda would be the larger goal of all propaganda in the West anyway. I'm not sure if we still need to separate West and East and whatnot, but I'm only familiar with the Western thing, and that has to do with it's a very ephemeral goal, really. I mean, I think it was William Casey, the CIA director, he said on record, I mean, what kind of mindfuck this is, I don't know, but he said, you know, when everything the American people believe is untrue, then our work will be done, back in the 60s. right. So I guess you could say his work's pretty much done, or their work's pretty much done. So I'd say that's Hollywood's really central in that. It's about, I think, it's about stripping human beings of autonomy. The end goal of the propaganda is that we will become completely dependent on propaganda and are state sanctioned. It's not even, it's subtler because it's sociological, but external values to define us. And therefore, you know, as part of that, we will have surrendered our autonomy completely to some amorphous kind of intelligence that we're now seeing in the world. You know, is it algorithms? Is it artificial intelligence? Is it the deep state? Is it, it's not really clear what it is, but it's clear that it exists and that it seems to exist to strip us of our autonomy by harvesting our attention, and that people are going along with it. I mean, we could talk about COVID-19 if we wanted to here, couldn't we? But there are palpable examples or evidence we can see that people have surrendered incrementally their autonomy. And of course, then they become vessels for externally incepted values, or it's a bit circular, really, isn't it? Cause and effect there. But as we become vessels for these externally incepted values, then the conquest is complete, really. We have Planet Borg. So I don't know. I mean, I don't want to be too paranoid, but it does look like that.
And what do you think there's anyone or anyone you know of or yourself perhaps who you've found some ways to regain autonomy, or people who have found autonomy and found the truths? You know, if everything we believe is untrue, then you know, who are those people you'd look towards who have escaped autonomy and who are finding truth again, if there is anyone?
Yeah, well, that's what I tried to get to in the last chapter, and I think it's a difficult question to answer, because one can then turn it into a binary system of us and them, and that can become elitist, and then one loses the spectrum or the continuum of human awareness, which seems to me that the reality that we've lost touch with, or central to it, is that we are all a single organism. Humanity is a single organism, a single spirit, single continuum of consciousness, all connected together, which is the true, you know, the Borg would be the shadow of that, like the artificially created counterfeit of that we are, like mushrooms in the forest, or trees, or most other animals, birds in murmuration. We see it throughout nature. Human beings are also interconnected in this way. And so, yeah, I'd want to be wary of that in terms of singling out. And in the book, I choose David Byrne and Talking Heads as a positive example of a cultural figure at the end. But I'm aware that I'm sure if I dig hard enough and long enough, I'd find things that would, you know, create cognitive dissonance and that would compromise my respect and love for David Byrne and Talking Heads. It's all one system. So I don't believe that anything that kind of makes it to us through mass media isn't somehow converted into a delivery device. But there are definite areas in our experience where we can connect individuals, really, where the transmission, if you like, is stronger, where the life force is stronger, where there's more integrity and there's more autonomy for whatever reason. And our discernment might be good or it might not be. That's why I'm wary of saying, oh, well, you know, David Byrne's an example of somebody who's a successful artist who's really true and has integrity. Well, no, maybe not. Maybe that's just my particular bias. But there is something in there that we can tune into that's real, is my point about Talking Heads, and I show that, and other people will have other things to do, you know, other things that they can get a sense of that. Here's some real life force, here's some real autonomy. But it's certainly not, I mean, the culture isn't the place to look for it. The place to look for it is in nature, and by that I mean in our environment. So I don't necessarily mean we've got to go and live in nature, but I'd include human beings as part of nature, and that somehow the less socialized and the less mediated interfaces with others are, the better. And then, of course, then it's finding, as you're asking, finding individuals who are oriented towards tuning into their life force, putting their attention, allowing their attention to withdraw, a bit like the turtle analogy, isn't it, in spiritual teachings or what have you, withdrawing our attention from the world, so, or at least, you know, enough of it so that enough of our attention can go to what's occurring inside of our bodies. And tuning into that, which is where, because how much we have so much awareness in our bodies, and our consciousness isn't meeting it. Our consciousness is always going out to the world, whether it's the Twitter feed or the Netflix or other human beings. But what do they think of me? And you know, this kind of always seeking validation from the world. That's a particular kind of attention where our consciousness is always going outward. But there's this whole world of awareness inside our bodies where our consciousness isn't. And I think that something can happen there. If our consciousness meets the awareness of our bodies, I'm actually paraphrasing Dave O'Shana now, but I do feel I have a sense of what he was talking about recently, then we start to have an experience that the awareness of the body, whether the life force is itself, becomes more conscious, and that it has a purpose for us, and we can start living the purpose of the life force, which is what other animals do. I say other, I'm not sure that human beings are animals, but what animals do and what human beings seem to have lost the ability to do, just live the life force in harmony with our own bodies and each other. So that would be autonomy. Yeah, I think that's the kind of autonomy that we can rediscover. And yeah, I mean, the short answer is I do know some people who are focused on this. But as I say, if it becomes too much about this or that group of people, then it could, I mean, it's just my thing, right? Anyone can find their thing. My thing currently is with Dave O'Shana in Finland, and it's very exciting. Unfortunately, a lot of it's on Zoom, so there is that, as far as it's not exactly unmediated. But I am discovering there's something about just connecting with people who are oriented towards, away from certain things that seem to be capturing the world's attention, towards something else that perhaps is more ephemeral and might be mistaken for something spiritual, or it might get stuck with that tag. But I really think it's something that's very innate to all of us, you know, all of our natures, and just how we live our lives, and why we have such a difficult time living our lives is there in the body. And that's why it was a bit confusing when you said that thing about how I said that the body didn't exist. I thought, well, how did I manage to create that impression? Because it's the very opposite of what I've been arguing over recent years. Yeah.
Is there anything you would like to add about the book? You know, if people are interested in our conversation here, how they could go about, you know, supporting the book?
Definitely, yes. So it's, as you've said, it's a very big book. It's very comprehensive without being encyclopedic. It's going to be probably a 600 page book, and I've created a fundraiser at the website, which I guess if you can link to it, that would be easier. But it's at my site, horticulture.com. Any page except the main page, you'll find the link to it. It's called 16 Maps of Hell campaign. And it's because I couldn't find a publisher for it, which was much to my surprise, because I thought it would be a timely, topical subject and it would be some mainstream interest. But I actually found it harder to publish than my other books, which maybe is significant in and of itself. But anyway, as a result of that, I've ended up just doing a crowdfunder. I'm trying to raise £660 as a starting point. And that would be for a run of about 200 books. If I raise a bit more, I'll do an audio book. And there's various different options at the fundraiser. But essentially, we're two-thirds of the way, and there's like 90 days to the campaign. So it started very strong. It's very, very likely that it will get published now. Just a question of how many. And so essentially, if anyone wants to support the campaign, they're more or less pre-ordering the book at this point, which is about $50. This is a very big book. But you also get to be included in the book as one of the contributors that made it happen.
If there's anything else you'd like to add, Jason, finish up.
I don't think so. Hopefully, maybe we can have a part two. Are you about halfway through, did you say?
Yeah, I'm about halfway through, so we can have a part two, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, if and when you finish it and you find that it's worthwhile, and I'd be interested to get your take on the ending and whether I managed to point to the exit of hell or not.
Yeah, I'm certainly intrigued to get out of hell. So, yeah, I'll let you know.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Well, thanks, James.